Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. The Midwest is sometimes called flyover country, and its music can get passed over too. The truth is that a lot of music got started in places like Cleveland, Detroit, Kansas City, and Chicago. Music writer Erin Osman should know. She grew up in rural Indiana and won an LA Press Club Award for her profile of Indiana native John Mellencamp. Mellencamp is just one of the working class artists that will be featured in Erin's next book, Won't Back Down, which covers the magic of Heartland Rock. She makes her third visit to Beta to speak with resident musicologist Steve Gotcher. They discover that there's a whole lot more going on in the Midwest musically than you might think there is.
There's very much this DIY spirit that has happened here over the years of people creating their own record labels. You know, you have Kooka there in Wisconsin, which was a huge independent record label. Labels all over Chicago, Indiana, little gospel scenes that kind of sprung up over all these states in the middle of the country. And I think that is really intrinsic to our traditions here. It's a lot of family groups, friends, people that just sort of started out from nothing and nowhere.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think a geographic region really influences the music that's made there?
I mean, I think it can. I think, you know, where we grow up inevitably makes its way into our lives, right? Like, we can't really escape the towns that we're from. And I think an interesting thing about the Midwest is, while a lot of people who grew up in the Midwest, like myself, tend to maybe want more than what their town can offer them, they also get to a place where they really want to honor and respect and sort of herald the place that they're from.
What kind of things happen to make the Midwest a place where jazz and blues and R&B and rock and roll could all flourish?
I mean, I attribute it to the Great Migration, right? All of those Black families that came up from the South for looking for opportunity here in Chicago and Detroit and Indianapolis and those sorts of places. Those communities inevitably came together to form some sort of creative thing that was needed for the vibrancy and sort of the endurance of a new community.
All we hear church people say, they are in this holy way. There are strange things happening every day.
You know, if we think about the garage rock scene in Detroit, so many music journalists like to sort of compare that music to the clanging of, you know, automotive factories, right? But there is probably a kernel of truth there. Like, when we think about someone like Bob Seger, who started off playing in garage bands in Detroit in the 60s, his father worked in the auto factory and so did he. It's back to that spirit of environment and sort of fortitude and creativity. All of these things that are sort of created in a vacuum, right? Because these are smaller areas that are overlooked by larger industry.
Right. Now, we talked about Chicago just a bit a minute ago, too, and you mentioned gospel music. Chicago is very well known for blues. How did that city become such a center for blues?
You know, it goes back to the Great Migration, and soul music and blues and gospel all have kind of a lot to do with one another. So when we think about an artist like Syl Johnson, for example, who's one of the great soul music singers, at a certain point, he realized that his skills could transfer to blues, and he became really focused as a blues guitarist and singer.
When you hear what I've got to say, I'm sure you won't be able to turn your head away. 'Cause what I'm gonna talk about, nobody, nobody, nobody wants to be without.
So I think there was a lot of that, a lot of kind of shifting between genres or people working together, or, you know, it was a product of the clubs that were available at the time where you could get a gig. So I think that there was a lot of synergy between those Black music scenes.
Right. And the blues, which came out of the South, was more of acoustic-oriented music. And it became more electrified as it got north in Chicago. But then it went over to England, and we had the British invasion.
Put their spoons full of diamonds. Put their spoons full of gold. Just a little spoon of your precious blood.
So how did all that happen?
Yeah, I mean, there were just these white rock and roll kids in England who became obsessed with finding these soul and blues 45s, right? Like Paul McCartney talks about this all the time. I actually just interviewed Ringo Starr a couple months ago for a magazine feature that's coming out soon. He talked about how, you know, he and the other Beatles were just so excited to kind of get these records because they didn't have it there, right? It felt, you know, something that was uniquely American and something that was sort of out of reach for them. So they started off as deep fans. And he tells this story about how when the Beatles first came to America for that Ed Sullivan appearance, they went and played a show in Florida. And some people that he met in Florida took him and the band to see the Coasters in Miami. And he couldn't believe it. He talked about how he was just such a fan and he was in awe of this performance. And all of the other kids around him were dancing. And he was like, you can't dance. You have to watch these guys. It's the Coasters. I think they became an important sort of evangelist for Black American music. You know, there are conversations around appropriation and all of that, which are fair.
Now, one of the most unlikely places that has significantly impacted the music scene is Minnesota, especially Minneapolis. What has the state contributed to the music scene?
Oh my gosh. I mean, there's such a legacy of Black innovation in Minneapolis. You know, Prince is obviously the king of that.
You don't have to be beautiful. You turn me on.
Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis came out of Minneapolis. They electrified, you know, funk and soul music to create this entirely new sound. You know, and then there's the punk scene out of Minneapolis. We have Husker Du and the Replacements and, you know, all of the bands that were working around that scene. And again, this is a point that I always make, especially to my students in my music journalism class that I teach at USC, but almost every American musical tradition goes back to Black communities and the Great Migration, and Minneapolis is the same.
Another place that has produced important music is the state of Indiana, specifically John Mellencamp. And you recently won an LA Press Club Award for your profile on John. How has his music represented his Midwestern roots?
I'm from Indiana, and I resonate really closely with John's story. It's the story of a guy who grew up in a rural area in southern Indiana without, you know, many connections to industry or anything like that. But he is just a kid who loved music. You know, read any early interviews with him or even now when he talks about his childhood, he was trying to get his hands on any records that he could. He listened to the radio, FM radio, constantly. And that's where he sort of developed this omnivorous taste that we see in a lot of musicians from Indiana. So he grew up listening to 50s and 60s soul music and also garage rock music and pop singers and things like that.
Well, there's a black man with black hair.
The songs that people were most responsive to, most positive about, were the songs that were most reflective of his own life. And also reflective of his friendships. George Green, his childhood friend, co-wrote a lot of John's biggest hits with him. You know, things like Hurt So Good. And so that was another kind of reflection of his community too, and that authenticity, right? Folding in a childhood friend who could help him write these songs. You know, John very much operated in a way that many people don't. In a way, John was sort of punk rock about the whole thing. You know, he stayed in Indiana, even though he had, you know, big city record deals. He worked with people in Indiana that he had known since childhood or that he specifically plucked because they were from Indiana. It's a really interesting model.
Yeah, yeah. Now, another city that is known universally for music is Detroit. And bands like the MC5, Iggy Pop and the Stooges, they pioneered punk music. And then Berry Gordy founded Motown Records and he promoted soul and R&B. Why do you suppose such diverse styles developed in the same town like that?
Yeah, I think, you know, Berry Gordy was very much a visionary, and I think his vision was to create something sophisticated. You know, he wanted to make Black artists look sophisticated to the world, and so that's why Motown, the artists that sprung from there, all have this sort of elegant look and feel and dance moves, and it was very much kind of a school for that sort of thing that became very successful. But then on the other hand, you know, when we think about the garage rock bands and the punk bands and Cream Magazine and things that were springing from Detroit, that is very much a product of the working class confines of that area, right? Like, you know, work on the equipment that you could get and afford, play in the bars that will have you, and then go clock in the next day at your shift at the auto factory, right? That was very much a true story of that time.
And let me kick out the jam. Yes, kick out the jam.
Now, there's a city we haven't mentioned, and it's kind of important to the development of rock and roll, and that's Cleveland. Tell me what Cleveland contributed.
Oh, my gosh. One of the most important contributions from Cleveland outside the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is they had a radio station called WMMS and a DJ there named Kid Leo, who was just a big proponent of rock and roll.
Kid Leo with you, 3:34 on the Monday edition, and Monday means rock line. Right now, brand new. For a guy that's been kind of a cult item for a while, I've been in this corner, John Hyatt. This is his first legitimate shot.
And he started playing artists like Bruce Springsteen very, very early. He helped foster the career of Michael Stanley, and Michael Stanley Band, which was very huge in Cleveland to this day. And because of sort of the vision and foresight of this DJ and the station, a lot of rock and roll bands across the country were broken on mainstream radio. And as a result, other radio stations paid attention, and it was sort of this ripple effect. And so that was huge. And then also, you know, Cleveland produced so many great punk bands. And then also the Black musical traditions out of Cleveland run really deep too. And so it's sort of a counterpart to Chicago in a way.
But how do we account for Pere Ubu?
I've got a vacuum cleaner in my head. It sucks up everything I know.
Well, you know, it's that misfit spirit that was sort of rippling through the city.
That's great. So what kind of effect do you think the digital age has had on regional music?
I mean, I think it's huge, right? Because the playing field has been leveled in terms of access and distribution. You know, anyone can record music and put it on a DSP. And so, you know, that's great. But it's also kind of made the volume of music sort of anxiety-inducing for listeners. So, you know, the means of discovery are different, especially for different age groups. But I think that's much more democratic in terms of access.
So do you think the Midwest still has more to say musically in today's world?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I mean, it is my opinion that Chicago is one of the best music cities right now. They are cranking out some of the coolest, most innovative young bands in the entire country. And I don't think that's ever going to go away there. Chicago's always been kind of a hub of innovation and creativity and music. But, you know, on the other hand, there are artists all over the Midwest that have made a big name for themselves. Like we think about someone like a Kevin Morby, right, who's doing his thing from Kansas. He just decided, you know, LA isn't for me anymore. I want to go home. And that's great because he's been able to sustain that from Kansas City, you know,
right.
And his partner, Katie Crutchfield.
You are a three-timer here on Beta, and that's because we love your writing. What are you working on these days?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I am finishing up my third book, and it is about the Heartland Rock Movement. So my focus is specifically on the 1980s, when this kind of coterie of musicians became kind of a commercial juggernaut, right? So we're talking about Tom Petty, Bruce Springsteen, John Mellencamp, and Bob Seger. Those are the big four. But I'm also writing in, you know, more minor characters, more women, right, that deserve recognition within this field that blew up under Reagan. And yeah, I'm looking at it holistically against, you know, the backdrop of politics and social happenings. And so it's sort of a mix of traditional reporting, which is what I've always done, with, you know, a lot of research and some commentary. It's kind of a blend, sort of like my John Prine book. But it's been such a joy to research and write this thing. You know, this music was being made when I was a child. Any Gen X or millennial like myself, you know, attributes this music to their dad, right? Like, this is the dad rock that we've long referenced. And it's funny because when I tell, you know, my friends or my music journalism peers about this book, they're kind of like, you like that music? You know, it's kind of like, but I do. I do love a lot of this music, but also, you know, you don't have to love all of the music to want to kind of explore it, right, and tell the story, because it held a lot of power and influence at a certain time. And it is representative of a movement and a scene that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
we don't have this mainstream rock explosion anymore. And so it's been really interesting to look at it.
Well, if your book is anything like your other books, I'm really looking forward to reading it. Aaron Ostman, it's such a pleasure to have you on Beta today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Aaron Ostman is an award-winning music writer. Our resident musicologist, Steve Gotcher, talked to her. Find out more about Aaron and her work at WPR.org/beta.
I love having sort of different sort of lost or found ways to present a book. I hope it's not just a gimmick. You know, it has to be part and parcel of the story.
Coming up, one of the masters of contemporary horror, Paul Tremblay, joins us to discuss his spine-tingling novel, Horror Movie. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. We're here in the middle.